Let's see if there are any. So what we have here, Nathan, Dr. Walton, if I may, is the core of the civil rights seminar class, undergraduate and graduate, and a few visitors. And I'm wondering if, I know I saw someone, if you are just visiting this class and are tuning in today for Nathan's seminar, can you just kind of like wave? I know, who is this? This is George Ondura, and then there's Karen. I know Karen Marsh. Are you upstairs? Are you upstairs? Yeah. George Ondura. Hey, tell me who you are. Are you in this class?
I'm in this class. I just joined a little bit late.
Have I met you yet?
I think so, kind of.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to see you. Anyone else? Liana? Are you in the class?
I'm in the class. I joined late too.
How are you doing? Join us?
Last week.
Okay. Well, I'm thrilled to see all of you here on a fair Wednesday afternoon. And it's really with just great pleasure and joy that I introduce you to our guest speaker today, who's really no guest, our visitor, Dr. Nathan Walton. I first met Nathan when he was, I think, a fourth-year undergraduate. Correct me if I'm wrong, at UVA, taking my Kingdom of God in America course. When would this have been? The years and decades just blur together, but this
spring
has been like
2009.
Yep, spring. And was a brilliant young woman named Diamond Bruner in that class, too.
Indeed.
Yeah, I think that's probably why you took the class.
I audited the class.
Okay.
I didn't even get credit for it.
Because Diamond and Nathan are now parents of two beautiful children, celebrating how many years of marriage?
Six in August, six a couple weeks ago.
And Diamond works in the Center for Public Health at UVA. What impressed me then, and certainly as I got to know him more closely in my role as his graduate supervisor, when he eventually came back from Duke to do his PhD at Virginia, was his passion and kind of skill in bridging the gap between religion and practice, broadly conceived, but also engaging issues of theology and society with critical sophistication and with kind of an empathetic imagination. Briefly, after he graduated from UVA the first time in 2009, Nathan received a full scholarship for studies at Duke Divinity School and completed his Master of Divinity degree at Duke. During those years, if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, he was part of a visioning team for a multi-ethnic congregation in the Durham Chapel Hill area. You also led financial literacy workshops for high school students in a summer camp in a low-income neighborhood and interned for a nonprofit ministry in DC that provided counseling and support for individuals returning to the community from incarceration. And these experiences helped ground his academic interest within the kind of lived theology and practices of real communities, communities of distress and many times exclusion. And you know, I think refined his already quite remarkable gifts of discernment in his interpretations of theology and practice. Nathan, if I may just continue for another moment or two, served as my teaching fellow, teaching assistant on two occasions. The student course evaluations always confirmed with abundant enthusiasm his exceptional abilities to teach and to equip students to think critically, and as he likes to say, to think productively about engagement in the social and political order. And I think you also served for a number of years as my graduate assistant. Nathan's doctoral dissertation, which I hope will become a book someday soon, just was a real tour de force. He generally treated the topic, the theme of the prosperity gospel, which he can, if the exchange seems appropriate, take some time with in our seminar today. But it was methodologically kind of sophisticated work, because he combined both, you know, religious ethnography, that is getting out into congregations and creating kind of thick descriptions of practices and belief at the ground level, but also his abilities as a young systematic theologian to think critically and constructively about the relationship between Christian thought and money. And in this kind of dazzling academic achievement, in trying to provide a corrective, if you will, to many of the theological kinds of exaggerations and mistakes, if I could be so bold, in the prosperity gospel, mainly this idea that true Christian devotion will inevitably yield financial prosperity. Nathan recruited two theologians, or at least their legacies, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr., to provide some kind of theological critique, but also to offer as theological corrections of some of the problems that we observe in the prosperity gospel, which, by the way, has had quite a comeback in recent years on the national scales. In any case, you'll see that Nathan just brings exceptional, truly exceptional energy to his scholarly and his community involvements and to his work in academic and public life. And I think represents the best of University of Virginia's mission to create public scholars, public intellectuals, in this case, a brilliant young public theologian. So I'm delighted that he has accepted our invitation to talk today on Martin Luther King Jr. and the witness of the Black Freedom Church. Dr. Walton, thanks again, and we look forward to your words.
Awesome. Well, first, thank you. Thanks to all of you. Thanks to Dr. Marsh for that helpful introduction and invitation. Thank you also to the Project on Lived Theology and Theological Horizons for their help in making this possible. And obviously, thanks to you all for coming out. If you weren't here, we wouldn't be doing this. So you're pretty essential for that. As a double who, I've been in many of you all's shoes. And while I can say it's better, it's definitely better on the other side once you get there. But I do still feel a bit of nostalgia for what it was like to be deeply embedded in academic community. Not nostalgia for the homework, of course, but the people, the conversations and those things. So all that to say, I'm excited to be with you all. So the title of today's lecture is Martin Luther King Jr. and the Witness of the Black Freedom Church. And I'm going to screen share. Let's see, make sure I can get my technology ready. Can you all see this? Oh, there we go. Everybody can see it? Nice. Let me get myself situated. So I should say that, you know, as we think about this phrase, the Black Freedom Church, this was originally coined by civil rights historian Charles Payne. And it refers, at least in part, to the Black churches that were engaged in the civil rights movement. Now, to be honest, today's topic could really be an entire series of talks, considering how much there is to say just about Martin Luther King Jr., as well as how much there is to say about the Black Freedom Church. Fortunately for you, I don't plan on saying everything there is to say about these two topics, especially since that would keep us here much longer than the hour or so that we have. And we all know that Zoom fatigue is a very real thing. So I keep that in mind. But in our time this afternoon, I'd like for us to discuss Martin Luther King Jr.'s role in the civil rights movement, particularly in terms of his indebtedness to the Black church and his unique contributions to Black liberation in America. So I'll begin by laying some historical groundwork, situating King within the context of the mid-20th century Black church and exploring how it shaped his theological outlook and social engagement. And following this historical framing, I'll then examine how King is in many ways a byproduct of this Black church tradition, as well as other social traditions. In other words, I want to first paint the picture of the historical and the theological sources that helped to facilitate King's formation. Then I'll turn to several key features that highlight King's unique contributions to the civil rights movement, including his historical understandings of nonviolent direct action, Christian love, and the paradigm of the Exodus. With that being said, two questions will guide our time together. First, how did King become King? What are the sources for his theological and social sensibilities? Second, how might we understand King's significance, both in terms of his own historical context and in terms of conversations and efforts today around social justice? Right? How do we bring it into the present? Afterward, we'll allot a little bit of time for questions and discussion. So let's begin. To understand the role and significance of the Black church for King's formation, it's important to first consider its historical role for the Black community in general. From its inception, the Black church has functioned as a staple of Black religious life, but also socio-political life. From the days of the first African slave converts to the religious lives of African-American Christians and during the Jim Crow South to the Black church today, African-Americans have long found relief and refuge from day-to-day oppression by participating in Christian community. Socially, this community has provided a space for corporate solidarity. It has given Blacks a space to affirm one another's dignity in a world in which they were often deprived of it. Particularly during slavery in the postbellum era, Black Christian communities were unique in that Blacks could exercise autonomy and even leadership, as the preacher was one of the first public leaders in the Black community. As communities of Black Christians throughout American history participated in the same rituals from singing to clapping to dancing, they also shared similar daily struggles, enduring the impacts of racism and discrimination. What this has meant is that Black Christianity was born in the midst of suffering and collective trauma. As a result, Black Christianity was always connected to the tangible. It was always connected to the lived experiences of those who practiced it. This has been evident in the specific biblical themes that have dominated Black church rhetoric. So for example, you know, Black preaching has done this, and even Black Christian music, from Negro spirituals to the rise of gospel music as a genre. They've been marked by themes of liberation and uplift, often drawing from biblical passages like the Exodus. So we'll come back to this topic a little bit later, but suffice it to say that Blacks found a message of liberation in Christianity, not just from sin, but from the concrete oppression of white supremacy. So on the one hand, Black Christianity's emphasis on the tangibleness of faith was an issue of rhetoric, as things like sermon content and song lyrics often reflected Black identification with Israel's journey towards freedom. But on the other hand, the tangibleness and physicality of faith was also reflected in expressive and embodied worship. Initially drawing from West African religious practices, the faith expressions of Black slaves always involved things like dancing, call and response, expressive singing, high emotion, and the assumption of the Spirit's presence. Christianity was an issue of both the mind and the body. They were always held together. And these are elements of Black religiosity that began in the hush harbors of slave religion and can still be seen today in many Black churches, especially Pentecostal churches. Now, I mention these things because they help to demonstrate that King's ability to seamlessly blend notions of personal piety with social activism were particularly impressive, but they weren't altogether novel. He inhabited a long tradition of religiously informed social engagement. King's involvement in the church began at an early age, as he was raised in a Baptist family, attending Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where his dad was the pastor. And although the Black church has a long-standing history of connecting piety with social engagement, when King was beginning to be formed within the church, he had not yet made the types of connections between those two things, between piety and activism, that would later characterize his work. As King got older, he did not even initially plan on becoming a preacher or a minister. That shift only became an interest after he enrolled at Morehouse College in Atlanta. There he was exposed to the preaching of people like Benjamin Mays, the college president at the time, and William Borders, another Baptist minister, who both effectively balanced compelling preaching with an intellectual rigor that helped King convince King of the gospel's social relevance. The interesting thing is that for the majority of his young adult life, King had doubts about the social relevance of his faith because he didn't see compelling examples of how emotionalism and an emphasis on personal piety connected to the Black struggle. Entering college, you know, and being exposed to more socially engaged examples of ministry, especially among Black Baptist ministers, these things deepened King's faith and increased his interest in becoming a minister. King would eventually become ordained in the Baptist Church in 1948. And the same year, King would enter seminary and begin reading people like Walter Rauschenbusch, an early 20th century theologian who drew deep connections between the biblical claims of Jesus about sin and an understanding of sin as a social and systemic phenomenon. So reading these thinkers like Rauschenbusch was not the first time that King drew this type of connection that that had already taken root a little bit in college, but it was at this point in seminary that he began to have a theological framework for these types of ideas. His reading of Rauschenbusch would lead him to say things like this: any religion which professes to be concerned about the souls of men and is not concerned about the social and economic conditions that scar the soul is a spiritually moribund religion only waiting for the day to be buried. That's pretty strong language. And 3 years later, King would enroll in a PhD program at Boston University School of Theology. And as King finished up his PhD, he would then accept a position as pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. So in terms of King's early adult formation, we see him grow up in the Black Baptist Church, begin to recognize the relationship between the Black church and social justice in a Baptist college and later at a Baptist seminary, and then ultimately returned to the Black Baptist Church as a pastor. This formation would later lead King to say these words in a 1965 interview: "I am many things to many people, but in the quiet recesses of my heart, I am fundamentally a clergyman, a Baptist preacher. This is my being and my heritage, for I am also the son of a Baptist preacher, the grandson of a Baptist preacher, and the great-grandson of a Baptist preacher." For King, this link to the Black church would begin as a familial connection and ultimately blossom into a personal commitment to living out this tradition within the context of the civil rights movement. So now that we've covered some historical ground, for the rest of this time, before we get to Q&A, I'd like to spend some time considering precisely what King's contributions to the civil rights movement were, specifically in terms of the ideas that undergirded his activism and those that were the most prominent in his speeches and in his sermons. I think it's appropriate to begin with King's understanding of the beloved community. King likely took this phrase from 19th century thinker Josiah Royce, but whereas Royce used it within the context of idealist philosophy, once it was in King's hands, this phrase took on new concrete meaning. King would use this phrase to capture precisely what was at stake in the civil rights struggle. After the Montgomery bus boycott, King said these words. He said, "It is true that as we struggle for freedom in America, we will have to boycott at times. But we remember that as we boycott, that the boycott is not an end within itself. The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of men." This notion of the beloved community will become a recurring theme in King's speeches and in his writings. And hopefully you guys have already started talking a little bit about this, but in many ways, the beloved community was what was at the heart of what the kingdom of God in his eyes looked like, what it looked like in the flesh, what it looked like in public. So for King, the beloved community involved several things. First, it involved peace. And peace in King's view had to go beyond just mere coexistence or mere tolerance of other people. Instead, peace was about justice, and it was about making things right concretely. Peace was about all people having equal access and opportunity in American society. Just as importantly, the beloved community was an ideal marked by mutual love. Love provides the motive for pursuing justice, and it's the fuel that sustains these efforts. This emphasis on love was a clear indication of King's Christian inheritance or Christian heritage, as Jesus' teachings on the love of neighbor and even the love of one's enemy deeply shaped King's social praxis. The language often used with this is agape, which we'll come back to. Now, the primary strategy for pursuing the beloved community was nonviolent direct action. King's concern for nonviolence was shaped by the practices of Mahatma Gandhi and his conviction that nonviolent direct action, King's conviction that nonviolent direct action could also coerce others into compliance. And that was actually influenced by theologian and ethicist Reinhold Niebuhr. Now, I don't know about you, but when I first started learning about these aspects of King's thought and the things that he did, one question would always come to my mind. What was it that made King so compelling and convincing, right? It's one thing to like have some good ideas, but a lot of people have good ideas. It's not necessarily new or novel. How do you go from having good ideas to then launching a world-changing movement to then having a national holiday on your birthday, right? So that's something that we have to consider, right? What were some of the things or some of the reasons why King was so compelling of a figure? What was it about the way that he engaged in his work? Obviously he was a great orator, right? He was highly educated and he was committed to the cause of social justice, but not all these things necessarily made him that unique. But it's important for us to consider what it was about this particular way of life and his particular work that would serve as such a great catalyst for social change. Now, there are a variety of factors, but in our remaining time, I want to explore this question by giving special attention to the role of the Exodus for King. Let me begin by saying that it's impossible to understand King's engagement with the Exodus without considering the African-American interpretive tradition that he inherited. King often employed what some call a figural hermeneutic, a way of interpreting the Bible common within African-American church traditions and dating back to the antebellum era, so pre-Civil War era. This approach affirmed continuity between biblical figures or tropes and contemporary people. So typology was the most significant type of figural interpretation for African-American hermeneutics in general, and King's understanding of the Exodus in particular. Typology affirms a continuity between figures and events as they are repeated in the Bible and as similar figures and events occur and subsequent history. So the Exodus then becomes not just an isolated historical account of Israel's deliverance, but an archetype, a story of liberation that is then echoed in subsequent liberative movements throughout history. For Black Christian slaves, their understandings and their self-understandings and their songs were shaped by this specific sensibility. So for example, they would draw connections between slavery in Egypt. They would draw connections between slaves and Israel, or between emancipation and the Exodus, or even between specific leaders and Moses, right? So Harriet Tubman's like one of the primary examples of that that we see. You can also see the liturgical role of typology as slaves adapted songs to reflect this interpretive tradition. Here's one example of this. Here's an excerpt from the song Go Down Moses, for example. So what you'll notice here is that there's some obvious allusions to Moses, to Egypt, to Pharaoh, those types of things. But here's one way it got adapted during the antebellum era. Right? Take a look at that. Oh, Father Abraham, right? Go down into Dixie's land. Tell Jeff Davis to let my people go, right? Like that, this, you see these parallels happening where Black communities are taking this other song and adapting it to their context. And this is typology at work. You're making these connections between these ancient archetypes and saying, what does that look like today? What are the examples of that today? And that's kind of the rhetorical function. And then it helps to empower the community to see themselves as identified with Israel. So within African-American hermeneutics or biblical interpretation within these communities, the category of typology cannot be equated or reduced to mere symbols or analogies, though. It's not just that. And there are two reasons why it's not just that. And here I'm drawing from Keith Miller and his work on King's hermeneutics, as well as Richard Lisher, who used to teach down at Duke. First, recurring types are understood more literally than analogies. So what I mean by this is that Black slaves did not just assume that they were similar to biblical Israel. They saw themselves as also actually being God's people. It's a bit stronger of a statement. And I should also say that this isn't some form of like replacement theology, right? Black slaves were not saying, hey, we're replacing Israel. It's just that they are identifying with the community of Israel. Second, these types are broader than mere symbols because they connote a worldview beyond the isolated or repeated figure or event. In other words, it isn't just about drawing a simple one-to-one correlation between slaves in Israel or slavery in Egypt. Black slaves instead saw themselves as also inhabiting a broader religious worldview associated with the Exodus narrative. So typology is about identification with the community in this case, but also the inhabitation of that community's world and its worldview. So on the one hand, the expansiveness of Exodus typology is clear from how multiple aspects of the narrative are often given contemporary appropriations, right? Whether that's Egypt or Pharaoh or Moses. But beyond the particularities of figures such as Moses or Pharaoh, the Exodus narrative painted a bigger picture of how God interacts with humanity and shaped how slaves understood their own journeys. Much of the effectiveness of the Exodus as a communal theme has been due to its interpretive capacity and expansiveness. And it has provided a lens that is nuanced enough to accommodate a variety of corporate experiences. As King scholar Gary Selby notes, the Exodus explained the successes they experienced, the problems they faced, and the disappointments they suffered. In the preaching, and especially in the singing of the spirituals, Black slaves were drawn to the Exodus for these reasons. As Union Army chaplain W.G. Kiffin reflected on how slaves were drawn to the Exodus, he claimed that, oh, I don't have a thing for that. Great. He claimed that there was no part in the Bible of which they were not so familiar as the story of the deliverance of the children of Israel, end quote. The conviction that the Exodus was a communal archetype and a hermeneutical framework were resound throughout African-American Christian history in general and resonate with King in particular. This conviction led King not only to identify the story of Israel with the story of Black Americans, but with the stories of all contemporary movements that sought the liberation of oppressed groups. King's hermeneutical and homiletical, or preaching, sensibilities were incubated in the church, but also influenced by his theological training. In addition to his familiarity with ways of engaging scripture within the Baptist church, Crozier Seminary further exposed King to higher biblical criticism while he was a student. Studying under figures such as George Washington Davis informed how King negotiated his commitments to evangelical faith alongside theologically liberal perspectives. And theological liberalism informed King's concern for the universal truths of the Bible, whereas evangelicalism within the context of Jim Crow made connecting these truths with practical realities indispensable. As King scholar Richard Lisher notes, between the pre-critical traditions of the Black church and the higher criticism of the exegetes, the theologian Davis mediated to King a progressive method of interpretation that moved from the particular to the universal and the corporate to the personal. Put more simply, King was often asking the big picture question, what do the specific claims and events of the Bible mean for the world, right? And what do they mean specifically for us? King's formative experiences in the South and later in seminary would shape how he read the Bible in the pew, as well as the pulpit. In the hands of King, the Exodus would then become a primary tool for illuminating the universal truth of God's liberative work, as well as empowering people to engage in the work in practical ways. One of the first significant examples of this perspective is in King's corpus, is the sermon, The Death of Evil Upon the Seashore, which I think you guys were assigned for today. In this sermon, King begins by affirming the reality of evil, pointing to biblical examples such as the creation narrative, as well as contemporary examples such as imperialist oppression and warfare. He contends that the major world religions each acknowledge a cosmic tension between light and darkness, good and evil. King then turns his attention to the biblical narrative of Israel's exodus from Egypt. In this sermon, King depicts the Egyptians as symbols of evil, colonialism, and oppression, while Israel symbolizes devotion to the God of the Hebrew people. This pivotal moment in the sermon, is the death of the Egyptians at the hands of God. King claims that the death of the Egyptians upon the seashore is a glaring symbol of the ultimate doom of evil in its struggle with good. The death of the Egyptians functions as evidence that God has defeated evil, and it foreshadows the ultimate defeat of evil cosmically. The Red Sea represents the inevitability of evil being overcome. And this sermon centers on the moment during the Exodus when Pharaoh's army has been destroyed and Israel has made it to the other side of the Red Sea. After summarizing the scene, King then connects the Exodus with the efforts of oppressed groups throughout the world to overcome colonial oppression. King initially refers to colonialism as a contemporary Egypt, before then transitioning to an analysis of America in which he refers to segregation as Egypt. For him, Egypt is this is an archetype really for systemic oppression. Yet although King does not see Blacks as having already entered the promised land, he reaffirms why they can still have hope. King describes the Supreme Court ruling against segregation as the parting of the Red Sea, and then broadens the scope, claiming that there is a Red Sea in history that ultimately comes to carry the forces of goodness to victory. For King, freedom, justice, and equality are both unrealized and inevitable. Yet it's precisely this liminal space between reality and redemption, unrealized flourishing, that provides a framework for understanding ongoing injustice and provides a rationale for continuing to fight against injustice. In other words, acknowledging this liminal space, this in-between space of unrealized redemption, makes sense of a broken world without denigrating those who've been broken by it, and it pushes Christians and others to work for change. While King identifies the Egyptians with the forces of evil, this perspective is nonetheless shaped by his commitment to nonviolence and the biblical command to love one's enemies. King urges his listeners, stating, "Let us remember that as we struggle against Egypt, we must have love, compassion, and understanding that goodwill for those against whom we struggle helping them to realize that as we seek to defeat the evils of Egypt, we are not seeking to defeat them, but to help them as well as ourselves. So there are several reasons why King provides these prescriptions. First, he views the command to love as not only compatible with, but inseparable from the necessity to fight for justice. Both direct action and nonviolence are means by which the oppressed resist the Egyptians, and the logic of agape love informs these practices. But second, his perspective is shaped by the scope of redemption. He believes that God desires both to free the oppressed and to transform the hearts of the oppressors. This is probably why King often refers to evil as a force, suggesting that evil is not reducible to specific people, but is a reality from which even the pharaohs of the world can and must be delivered. Third, King's emphasis on loving one's enemies in spite of the textual account of the Egyptians facing death demonstrates the fluidity of typological interpretation, perhaps reflecting the theological liberalism he imbibed while attending Crozer Seminary. King prefers to focus on the universal truth of evil's defeat over the implications that physical death in the actual text might have for exegetical application. In other words, by focusing on the universal, he attempts to resist the conclusion that those occupying the position of the Egyptians must now face death. This sermon promotes a particular way of seeing the struggle for liberation, but it also portrays a vision of communal identity. Narrative identification becomes a helpful category for understanding precisely how King's sermon presents the Exodus story and invites his hearers to enter that story. On the one hand, narrative identification shapes how hearers are led to identify with Israel as the protagonist community in the text. For example, King asserts that many years ago, the Negro was thrown into the Egypt of segregation, and his great struggle has been to free himself from the crippling restrictions and paralyzing effects of this vicious system, end quote. This emphasis communicated to King's listeners a sense of who they were as God's people and that they were in the process of working towards freedom with God's help. On the other hand, narrative identification also shapes how King's hearers are intended to feel. King encourages his listeners, stating, "Let us not despair. Let us not lose hope or lose faith in man, and certainly not in God. We must believe that a prejudiced mind can be changed, and that man, by the grace of God, can be lifted from the valley of hate to the high mountain of love." Here, King again connects the hope of divine liberation with agape love for one's oppressors. As God's people, their community must not lose hope in divine deliverance, and it also must not lose hope that oppressors can experience redemption. Further, since King often opts to identify evil as a depersonalized force rather than exclusively as specific people, he reveals how narrative identification helps his hearers to understand their oppressors in specific ways relative to the Exodus. On the one hand, he leads his hearers to associate specific people with the Egyptians. Yet although this identification is actual, it is neither exhaustive nor logically necessary. Put more simply, their oppressors are currently functioning in the role of the Egyptians, but their possible redemption and the reality of evil as a cosmic force means that they do not have to remain Egyptians. Narrative identification reveals how King's sermon led his hearers to conceptualize their own identities, the identities of their oppressors, and the identity of God relative to the Exodus story. When King originally delivered this message, his remarks helped to further inscribe this communal identification with the Exodus narrative, or what Gary Selby refers to as a movement consciousness, several months before large-scale efforts such as the Montgomery bus boycott began. In addition to this paradigmatic sermon, Death of Evil Upon a Seashore, King's speeches also contain important references to Israel's journey. As the Montgomery bus boycott was swinging into full gear, King would remark, "You don't get to the promised land without going through the wilderness. Though we may not get to see the promised land, we know it's coming because God is for it." In context, a judge had just fined King for violating anti-boycott laws. King's response to this is significant because he demonstrates how the journey through the wilderness is not exclusively a description of opposition to freedom at the communal level, but it can be a way to interpret personal obstacles as well. The difficult journey toward freedom that the Exodus narrative captures sheds light on both systemic hindrances and personal struggles. Later in a speech a few months after the Montgomery bus boycott ended, King would urge his listeners stating this: "Go out with that faith today. Go back to your homes in the Southland with that faith today. Go back to Philadelphia, to New York, to 1957 Detroit and Chicago with that faith today. That the universe is on our side in the struggle. Stand up for justice. Sometimes it gets hard, but it's always difficult to get out of Egypt. For the Red Sea always stands before you with discouraging dimensions. And even after you've crossed the Red Sea, you have to move through a wilderness with prodigious hilltops of evil and gigantic mountains of opposition. But I say to you this afternoon, keep moving. Let nothing stop you. Move on with dignity and honor and respectability." In context, King's remarks during this speech primarily concern the right for Blacks to vote. He acknowledges that much work is yet to be done, but his rhetoric never loosens its grip on the importance of hope. Here, King claims that his hearers must not accept the status quo, but must continue to fight for their rights to have equal rights as citizens. King affirms the tension between realism and optimism that the logic of the Exodus journey embodies within the African-American interpretive tradition. In addition to the death of evil upon the seashore, a second significant sermonic example of King's appropriation of the Exodus was his sermon, Birth of a New Nation. The Birth of a New Nation, originally delivered a couple months after the end of the Montgomery bus boycott, was inspired by Dr. King's visit to Ghana as he celebrated its independence from Britain. This sermon begins with an account of how Africa was originally colonized by European powers and the Gold Coast, at the time, now known as Ghana, fell under British rule. King describes how colonialism not only brought about tangible oppression, but violated the freedom that is basic to being human. As a result, in Ghana as well as other countries, the inevitable desire to become free manifested in resistance to imperial control. King states that there is something in the soul that cries out for freedom. There's something deep down within the very soul of man that reaches out for Canaan. Men cannot be satisfied with Egypt. Here, King contextualizes the fight against colonialism within humanity's basic quest for freedom, while also interpreting this quest through the lens of the Exodus narrative. Just as Israel longed for the freedom associated with the Promised Land, all oppressed people share this existential yearning. In the case of Ghana, King notes the pivotal work of Kwame Nkrumah to push for Ghana's independence, and Nkrumah's imprisonment and his eventual rise to become Ghana's first president. In this sermon, King draws parallels between the Exodus and Ghana's freedom from the British Empire, as well as the American Civil Rights Movement. As King describes the independence of Ghana, he remarks, "This nation was now out of Egypt and it crossed the Red Sea. Now it will confront its wilderness. Like any breaking loose from Egypt, there is a wilderness ahead. There was a problem of adjustment." It's noteworthy that King does not view the Promised Land as the next step after the Exodus. Rather, he acknowledges the wilderness ahead, alluding to the long transition, not just from bondage to freedom, but from freedom to flourishing. Put differently, even the progress of experiencing the Exodus does not accomplish the fullness of freedom. There's still much to confront and to endure. Later in his sermon and elsewhere, King mentions that even in the Promised Land, you have to deal with opposing giants. And in those passages, he's echoing the biblical story of the conquest of Canaan, in which Israel's entrance into the Promised Land is fraught with struggle and fraught with resistance. One of the first obstacles they encounter is a bunch of giants in the land. King's point is that the Promised Land is not yet realized, and even if it were, this does not mean that all is well. The crucial takeaway from King's reflections is that he is able to embrace this tension between affirming hope and affirming a framework for ongoing unrealized beloved community. In other words, hope is not a blind or a passive optimism, but requires that people continue to fight for change. King's 1965 speech, A Christian Movement in a Revolutionary Age, also reveals how he embraces this tension between hope on the one hand and unrealized beloved community. In this speech, King begins by acknowledging how scripture reveals God as invested in social revolution, particularly within the context of understanding God's role in the Exodus. King suggests that the revolution God intended was both personal and societal. He remarks, saying, "The God of our fathers is a God of revolution. He would not be content with anything less than perfection in his children and in their society." King then continues his frequent rhetorical pattern of connecting biblical narratives with contemporary civil rights struggles. He gives this address in light of both the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, affirming that these are important moments in the quest for liberation. Nonetheless, he recognizes that the fight for freedom is far from over. He asserts, "And now we have come to the threshold of the promised land. We have shattered the legal barriers of segregation and discrimination, but there are new giants that await us in the land. These giants not only threaten us as Negroes, but they threaten the structures of our entire society." Here King recognizes that progress has been made, but alludes to the biblical story of Israel's journey toward the promised land to describe the remaining obstacles to equality. The Hebrew Bible notes that when Israel sent spies into the land of Canaan as they were beginning the conquest, they quickly noticed and were intimidated by these giants who were in the land. These giants stood in the way of an easy conquest of Canaan. King's claims that in the American context, the giants, King claims that the giants in the American context are political reform in the South, economic reform in the North, and establishment of a community of peace and freedom throughout the world. So King continually embraces the tension of affirming progress while acknowledging ongoing struggles. He suggests that not only have Americans not yet entered the promised land, but that even when they do, there will still be work to be done. At the same time, he suggests that hope is on the horizon as the Exodus has in fact begun. King's reflections on the Exodus from the earliest version of the death of evil upon the seashore to the birth of a new nation sermon demonstrate important rhetorical shifts. In the earliest version of the death of evil upon the seashore, the earliest version of that sermon delivered in July of 1955, the crossing of the Red Sea is the pivotal narrative moment. In particular, events such as Brown versus Board of Education and around that time are identified as the moment of this crossing. It is not until later versions of this sermon that the wilderness is mentioned and assumes a greater rhetorical role. By later versions of the sermon, and especially during speeches around the time of the Montgomery bus boycott, King draws from the biblical account of Israel's wanderings in the wilderness to articulate the realities of both progress and ongoing obstacles in the struggle for civil rights. This shift reveals one way that King's engagement with Israel's Exodus is consistently in conversation with the changing social and political landscape of his hearers. By the time he delivers his speech, the speech "I've Been to the Mountaintop," King situates his hearers yet further along Israel's journey out of Egypt, on the cusp of the promised land. On the one hand, King's reflections on the Exodus throughout his career frequently place his community and their struggles within the context of Israel's exodus from Egypt. Yet at each moment, an acknowledgement of progress is fully integrated and compatible with the reality of unmet expectations. In addition to shifts from an exclusive focus on the crossing of the Red Sea to then incorporating later moments in Israel's exodus, there's also a rhetorical shift in his writings and his explicit use of the Exodus. As Gary Selby notes, by the time King preached his Birth of a New Nation sermon, King had transformed the Israelites from the passive recipients of God's gracious actions to agents with the ability to choose to rise up against injustice, and who, through their determined efforts, succeed in moving to the Promised Land. While the death of evil upon the seashore sermon emphasizes God's work on behalf of the Israelites, by the time he delivers Birth of a New Nation, King offers a more urgent and specific charge to engage in current liberative efforts. King never suggests that human agency and divine agency are mutually exclusive, but as civil rights efforts unfold, King increasingly emphasizes the role that social justice work plays and God's ongoing effort to bring reconciliation. To this end, in Birth of a New Nation, he encourages his hearers to rise up and know that as you struggle for justice, you do not struggle alone, but God struggles with you. Throughout King's sermons and speeches, the Exodus functions as a crucial motif. The biblical account of Israel's journey out of bondage toward freedom provides an interpretive lens for his hearers to understand their own communal identity, the identities of their oppressors, and the identity of their God. On the one hand, King's references often included more extensive reflections on Israel's journey with descriptions of events like the crossing of the Red Sea or Israel's journey through the wilderness. And the Death of Evil Upon the Seashore and Birth of a New Nation sermons are primary examples of that approach. Yet King will also allude to these biblical scenes with briefer references that would bring the entire narrative to mind. As one scholar notes, in King's rhetoric during the Montgomery bus boycott, his references to the Exodus take the form of a code through which a brief passage, often a phrase or a single word, captivity, Egypt, Pharaoh, Red Sea, wilderness, promised land, is used to evoke the larger story, right? It's a part of the linguistic fabric of how he does this. Yet regardless of the extent of King's explicit description of the Exodus, the rhetorical effect remains profound. These references had a galvanizing and mobilizing impact on his listeners, evoking a sense of communal solidarity, of hope, and mission. Communal hope stemmed from the remembrance of God's past actions, whereas a sense of ongoing mission affirmed the reality of unrealized beloved community. So as we take a step back to consider the factors that led to King's effectiveness as a civil rights leader, there are a lot of things that obviously played a role. You have the social component of King being an effective speaker and motivator. You know, when we think of King, it's hard not to think first of riveting sermons. And to this day, people are still amazed by his use of cadence and repetition and tone, not to mention his actual claims. You also have the economic component that contributed to King's success, namely King's ability to work with others to strategize boycotts and other initiatives that affected local economies. Applying pressure in these ways was essential for promoting change. You also have things even outside of King, like respectability politics. In other words, over time, America's concern about its global image had an impact on its willingness to change. One example would be the cultural impact of mass media after the violence of the marches on Selma. It's a bit hard to say that nothing needs to change in our country when images of dogs attaching unarmed protesters flood your TV screen, right? In our own historical moment, we can easily see the difference video has made in public perceptions of injustice towards Black Americans, even today. But collectively, all these factors played a role in King's success, whether they be social factors like his rhetorical impact, economic factors like boycott strategies, or cultural factors like mass media. But I'd like to argue another, perhaps even more significant factor in light of the Exodus, and that is that much of King's effectiveness stemmed from his ability to draw his listeners into a communal narrative of progress towards freedom. On the one hand, Blacks saw themselves as identified with Israel on the road to the Promised Land, and King's emphasis on loving and reconciling with whites suggested that they too were being invited into this journey of liberation. A few years ago, I heard a quote that I think captures this well. I heard someone say, "Activism is organized storytelling." I think that King provides an example of this. Activism is organized storytelling. Now, I don't think that activism is reducible to storytelling in like a crude sense, but there is a lot of truth to this idea that what mobilizes people is a narrative within which to belong and a narrative within which they can find meaning and purpose. I think we see this a lot actually in politics today. I remember actually when I was a student, getting ready to shift into being one of Marsh's students. I remember 2008, during the election season, people were so inspired about the possibility of America's story reflecting this new manifestation of hope and change, right? That was the rhetoric, hope and change. And the irony is that I feel like a similar dynamic happened years later with Trump, in that even though his message is radically different than Obama's, in that it drew from the rhetoric of fear as opposed to hope, at the end of the day, he's telling a story that certain segments of our society believe they can find themselves in. I think this idea of identification with a communal narrative has a lot to teach us about how social movements actually function in our country and in our world. So I'd love for us to reflect more on how these types of insights from King's message and his methods might inform how we understand our own moment. So I've talked a lot, and I'd love to kind of hear from you all what comments or questions bubble to the surface for you, whether they be about King specifically or about King's relevance for our contemporary moment. And so I'll yield my time to Dr. Marsh.
Oh, that was just absolutely splendid. Thank you so very much. Nathan, who said activism is organized storytelling?
I don't have the reference right in front of me, but I can get that to you.
Was this at a CCDA or something like that? Or
you know what? I think it might have been I think it was the first CCDA that I went to a couple years ago. Yeah.
That's a splendid quote. I'm tweeting some things out from class, and I was going to tweet that. That was absolutely splendid. And in 45 minutes, you really gave us a very rich and conceptually sophisticated, also historically kind of grounded narrative of King and the Black Church tradition. Let's just open up, if this is okay for you, we have about 15 or 20 minutes for questions and comments from the students. So they're all raring to go, chomping at the bit.
I'll do what I can. You can tag team with me if they ask me a question I don't know the answer to.
I don't think that's likely.
I have a question.
Great.
Do you perhaps see any comparisons or any relevancy to this type of idea that the idea of struggle where in today's current Black Lives Matter movement, do you see any connections between say the Exodus and this movement?
That's a fantastic question. Yes, the short answer is yes. Thinking broadly, there's definitely a connection in terms of just the desire to be free, right? Freedom is a part of the language and the rhetoric, even within the Black Lives Matter movement. I think what's also interesting is that, there's been a lot of conversation about kind of the relationship between the Black Lives Matter movement in terms of some of its core sensibilities and those who were fighting during the civil rights movement, right? And so one thing we noticed from studying civil rights history is, and then Dr. Marsh talks about this in his book, Beloved Community, in many ways, it was a religiously informed movement, right? You have Baptist preachers and others pushing forward this movement. And so it's interesting, when I talk to people, how should I explain this? Some of the conversations around the Black Lives Matter movement has been questions about what does it mean for it to not as explicitly be grounded in these Christian or Christian language and Christian ideas. And I think what's interesting about that is, when King talks about, this identification with Israel, in some ways he talks about that as the Black community and their push towards freedom. But there's also rhetoric that he uses that shows it in a very expansive way. And what I mean by that is there's this idea that Israel is this archetype for all peoples who are moving towards freedom. And so I think that in some ways that kind of reveals a closer connection than some might say between the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s and the Black Lives Matter movement, because even though there isn't the same level of religious undertone or overtone, there's a lot of this, a lot of similar underlying aims. And so I think that's one kind of connection. There are obviously are some other differences in the movements in terms of just the way that charismatic figures function, right? So like the Black Lives Matter movement has been very intentional about not centralizing one figure as the spokesperson. Whereas for a lot of Americans, when they think about the civil rights movement, especially if they haven't studied it extensively, they think about MLK as opposed to Ella Baker or Ralph Abernathy or others, right? So generally there's that kind of distinction, but so I think kind of the push within like the rhetorical force of the Exodus narrative does have parallels with the current Black Lives Matter movement, but there is not the same level of language overlap, right? You don't see a lot of Black Lives Matter protesters quoting the Exodus, like, at least I haven't. but the underlying sensibilities actually have, there's a certain level of affinity there.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Karen.
First off, thank you. It was so interesting. And just like the way that you tied all the ideas together was so fascinating. My question is, do you know if MLK had any thoughts on like the Canaanites or like the native population that essentially got like obliterated under the command of God? Did he have any thoughts about tying that idea, who they represented, if that piece of the narrative should even be a part of the movement?
That's a fantastic, y'all ask great questions. So I have to go back and look into this, right? That in what I've read, like, that doesn't seem to be the force of it. Now what's interesting is thinking about like shifts in biblical hermeneutics over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. You know, you have the rise of what's called post-colonial hermeneutics, which is really like asking questions like that, right? Asking questions of, okay, if we're reading, you know, biblical stories in the book of Judges or the book of Joshua, what does it mean to not put ourselves in the role of Israel, but to put ourselves in the role of those who are being invaded? That's actually a pretty, like, broadly speaking, I feel like that's still a fairly recent development in kind of shifts in biblical interpretation. And so in some ways, to the degree that King doesn't focus on that specifically, I feel like that's maybe a reflection of him being a reflection of his own time and some of the interpretive strategies that those in the communities he came from were using. I don't think that if King were on the Zoom call, which he isn't, but if he was, I don't think he would be opposed to thinking deeply about how we should wrestle with that reality. Yeah. What's interesting is he has this way of, and this is kind of what I was trying to get at with typology. There is this fluidity to how interpreters kind of use these different communities, right, and how they draw connections between like contemporary struggles and what's happening in the text. And so like if you think about kind of the grand sweep of what King has articulated in his writings, he's very much always talking about you know, I mean, it's what modern theologians would call like God's preferential option for the poor, right, and the oppressed. Like he's always thinking about, you know, what is God doing in this text to bring these people to flourishing, and now what must we do in response to that in our own context? And so I think he would definitely have a lot to say about that. I just don't know exactly what he would say about the Canaanites, because I don't see him addressing that in quite the same way that you're mentioning. But I think it's a great question. And I think he'd have really helpful things to say. Hayden.
I had a quick question just about kind of the notion of possession of a narrative in previous studies that I've done. The idea of kind of the history of America seeing themselves as modern Israelites. But then King uses this and is very specific in the Black community and in civil rights movement. And it's said to have clashed with the American notion of themselves, specifically the white Christian notion of themselves as the new Israelites. And like, how does he kind of deal with, or does he, or is there any notion of this is our story, not yours, or I would assume that King would not necessarily be in that line of thinking, kind of due to his universal notions of narratives and narratives of liberation. But I was just really, really curious about how one group can either possess their own or kind of claim this story, maybe to the exclusion of another.
That's a fantastic question. That's a very rich question. How should I answer that? So I think at a very basic level, I think he would find it very hard for those who are the powers that be that actually lead to the oppression in America. I think he would think that person would be hard pressed to actually justify how they can identify as Israel, right? I think what's interesting is you use the language of possession, which to me actually feels very different than identification, right? So like if a group can possess something, in some ways it feels more like now the narrative is kind of at your disposal for your own means, as opposed to any oppressed group can identify with this specific people in the text, right? Because as soon as you move outside of the group of the oppressed, you no longer have that identification. Whereas if you possess the text, which is what American culture and American society has tried to do, then the text becomes a weapon in a lot of ways, right? And so I think part of what he would do is he would try to, as a Baptist preacher, he would try to show how, in order to be faithful to the text, you have to recognize that if we're talking about an oppressed group in the Bible, i.e. Israel, you can't be the oppressor and claim that's you, basically. And so I think that's at a basic level what he would try to do. But yeah, it's very interesting. In some ways, what you said kind of speaks to just the, it's just interesting how the exact same text can be used in so many different ways. And so in some ways the tension says just as much about the way that biblical interpretation functions in our society as it does about the people doing the interpreting. If that makes sense. Yeah, because I mean, you see a similar dynamic where, like, if we think about slave history and the ways that slave masters also use Bible verses to justify what they're doing, right? And so, in some ways, it speaks to like the ways that, I guess the scriptures kind of, I don't exactly how to explain it, but there's a certain type of hermeneutical flexibility that's there, and. You know, the onus on us as readers of scripture to actually be ethical in the way that we engage it. But yeah, that's a fantastic question.
Thank you.
Karen, follow up.
Yeah, sorry. This is kind of a follow up to Haven's question. But how do you think that, like, MLK's narrative of Exodus kind of interacts with that, like, white American Exodus manifestation of American exceptionalism? I guess, like, in other words, would MLK maintain this concept of American exceptionalism but just reform what exceptional means, or would he just completely obliterate this conception of, like, America, like, the spatial exceptionalism, and kind of like abstracting it to a more like less concrete, yeah, understanding of the promised land?
Great question. I think he would obliterate it in some ways. And part of the reason why I say that is as he's talking about, identifying oneself as a member of God's people or God's community, or identifying with Israel, he's thinking about that, you know, transnationally, right? So like someone can be in South Africa and they can identify with this narrative and with this community because of their social location, right? And so that makes it much harder to distinguish America as a, you know, from other nations as the exceptional community. And so I think he would take issue with that, with the premise that America can be singled out in that way. Now, what America can be singled out, the role that America can definitely play is as Egypt in its own context. but as a power, in some ways, it's fundamentally not going to be able to portray itself as Israel as a country, because the country is the power in some ways. But great question. I think the biggest point to in response is that he thinks about the scope of the Israel community, like typologically speaking, as being global, right? Because it's about all those who are under the foot of oppression around the world, who are now able to identify with this narrative, find hope in this narrative, and be inspired to push for change.
May I jump in here real quickly?
Sure.
In response to those two really terrific questions and to your brilliant probings, I've sent around that short piece by Albert Rabiteau called American Salvation. Isaac, could you put that on the screen if possible? And Albert Rabiteau was until recently a professor of religious studies in American African-American religious history at Princeton University. And he wrote an extraordinary book called Slave Religion that was his doctoral dissertation that using archives and his own remarkable skills as a theological interpreter, piecing together the kind of rich and multi-layered and the theological moves and retrievals that are observed in the rituals and the song and the material culture of slave religion. So this piece that I'm going to call him Al because I know him and he's just a dear person. Do you all have a copy? Can I just point your attention, sure. Nathan, to like the third and fourth paragraphs, and you tell me if this helps.
Sure.
With those questions. So, does everybody see it? Yep.
Yep.
Oh yes. Yeah, so, can we just go to the top? Let's go to the top. Yeah. So, G.K. Chesterton. I'm just going to read three paragraphs. Once called America a nation with the soul of a church, he was referring in part to the habitual tendency of Americans to cast political and social events as scenes in the drama of salvation. I'm just gonna read this from my files. From the start, America's story was a religious story. In the 1630s, English Puritans represented their journey across the Atlantic to America as the exodus of a new Israel out of old world slavery into a promised land of milk and honey. And through the centuries, the story of the American Israel would serve as our nation's most powerful and long lasting myth. But to Black Americans, the nation was not a new Israel, but the old Egypt, condemned to sure destruction unless she let God's people go. The existence of slavery, segregation, discrimination, and racism contradicted the mythic identity of Americans as a chosen people. African-American Christianity has continuously confronted the nation with troubling questions about American exceptionalism. Perhaps the most troubling, if Christ came as the suffering servant, who resembled him more, the master or the slave? Suffering slave Christianity stands as a prophetic condemnation of America's obsession with power, status, and possessions. African-American Christians perceived in American exceptionalism a dangerous tendency to turn the nation into an idol and Christianity into a clan religion, except out of this prophetic tradition, the civil rights movement emerged in the 1960s to offer one of those most powerful critiques of American society, and including not only Jim Crow in the South, but eventually what Martin Luther King Jr. would call the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. So how does that get at how you might, or we might answer Haven and...
I think that's great. you could just show that.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a canonical little piece. It was written in 2005 in the Boston Review. But he's wanting to sort of see this tradition as a corrective, an exemplification of a counter narrative, of a counterculture that resists the prevailing kind of ethos of domination.
So, yeah, that's great. I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's funny, like, you know, thinking about, you know, Europeans coming to America in some ways, like if you're talking about the Puritans, for example, right, under the guise of like, we're being religiously persecuted. And so like, in some ways it's like, oh, there's a connection there, but then pretty soon there's slavery in America. So it's like, it's hard to kind of see the ways that it's hard to justify how, you know, America as an entity can really lay claim to the role of Israel, because it's fraught with all these complexities and problems. But Egypt is much, much easier to claim.
All right, so, you know, a recasting of the Exodus story. One that's not built on, you know, triumphalism, but on a very different kind of practice and rendering of, you know, the Christian faith in lived experience.
That's right.
What other questions? This is so good. We have 5 or 8 more minutes. You all are really making this come alive.
I have a question, sort of, or a thought.
Great.
I guess I'm a lifelong learner here.
We all are. Just some of us admit it.
Would it be accurate to say that much of white America, white American Christians, were comfortable to see themselves as oppressors of Black America in the 50s and 60s, but now they're more comfortable seeing themselves as the victims of a changing demographics in our society, and they're losing power?
That's a great question. I almost feel like it'd be, I almost want to defer the question. I don't know if I want to be the Black person speaking about what white, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, I definitely like in the present day, there is this, and I want to make a blanket statement about all white people or all white Christians, but I definitely feel like there is an element in our society today of embracing that victimhood, right? Even when the group expressing that clearly has a lot of power. And so that to me is curious and ironic in some ways. I guess what I'd be curious about is thinking about going back to the 60s, because the parallel that you're making is between people embracing kind of a narrative of victimization now versus being okay with being oppressed in the past. And there's a part of me that feels like, I think that is true, but I also think that I wasn't alive in the 50s and 60s, but I feel like during that time, there's something going on there that's still going on today. And that is, people often don't see themselves as oppressors. Like, they don't, like, people hate to be called racist. Like, and so I think in some ways, there's always this push to say, like, yeah, there are bad people out there, but I'm not as bad as them. Right. And so this is, you know, part of, and I think about this even in light of the marches on Selma, right? Where, you know, all of a sudden these visual images of like what Blacks are really enduring. And so I think that was kind of this reckoning of, oh, we really are doing this as a society. And so I don't think that, I think that for some people were just racist and they're fine with being oppressor. I think for others, they tell themselves a narrative or a story that makes them think they actually aren't as bad as they actually are. And I think that specific trend is still going on today. So to me, that's the consistency. But certainly you see you see that dynamic happening too, where you have those during the civil rights era who are in the role of oppressor and are fine with being oppressor. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, wanting to maintain, whether that be the Southern way of life or maintain comfort or whatever. Whereas now I think there definitely is a strong segment of our society that embraces this role of being the victim, being the person who's, being the person who is living with fear of losing everything you got, right? So you need to somehow maintain or reclaim or, and so I think that's happening. I don't, like, to me as a pastor, I'm always struck by that because I'm just always struck by the mobilizing role of fear in general, and the ways that fear and, because a lot of the victimhood has to do with like the fear of what's going to be taken from us, right? Or the fear of, you know, being taken advantage of, right? And so, and I just have a lot of questions about the way that functions as opposed to us operating out of stronger sensibilities of love towards our neighbor, right? Instead, we operate out of fear of what could be lost. And so that's a longer way of me answering your question, but I do think at a general level that what you said is true. I just think in the 60s, there were groups of people who were in the role of oppressor, but actually didn't view themselves as really the bad races, which is actually the trickiest part of people. But go ahead, Karen.
Sorry, I feel like I've asked many questions. I know Julia had her hand up.
As long as they're good, it's fine.
Go ahead, Julia, and then we'll come back to...
Oh, great.
Julia, take it away.
Okay. I just wanted to comment on what you were saying with the idea that you're a victim because of all this change going on. It just reminded me of something that MLK said in the Our God is Marching On speech. He was talking, so it seems like that rhetoric, that idea that you're a victim and there needs to be this return to normalcy has continued on, I mean, since I'm sure the times that people were trying to abolish slavery. So he said, I know there is a cry today in Alabama. We see it in numerous editorials. When will Martin Luther King, SCLC, SNCC, and all these civil rights agitators and all of the white clergymen and labor leaders and students and others get out of our community and let Alabama return to normalcy? And then he goes on to describe that they won't let it return to normalcy. And that really reminded me of the Black Lives Matter movement and people asking when it's going to return to normal and when it's going to be, especially this summer, I think, right in June, when people were asking like when it's appropriate to start posting regular pictures on social media and things like that, like when will there be this return to normalcy? And I think the idea that both the Black Lives Matter movement and the Civil Rights movement have perpetuated is that there won't be, there's never going to be a return to normal. It's that we're going to keep like moving forward, I guess.
Yeah, that there won't be and that they shouldn't be, right? Like part of the concern is that we don't want to go back to what it was.
Yeah, exactly.
That to me is the big thing. But yeah, that's really insightful and helpful. Because the same type of dynamic happened with like, you know, when the last election season was happening, right? Because there's a question of, okay, are we trying to go back to some bygone era to make America great again? Or are we recognizing that it wasn't necessarily great for everybody, right? And so I think we're operating with very different conceptions of what's normal, which is to say we're operating with very, very different conceptions of what should actually be the reality for people in our country. But yeah, it's a great point.
I just have a quick question or a quick thought. So I was noticing after watching the like DNC convention, I was noticing a lot of people saying like we need to save the soul of America. And then coming into this class and seeing the, you know, from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the redeeming the soul of America, I was just kind of wondering, like, what you think, how it kind of paralleled and how
I can't hear you. Is that my computer? Okay.
Leadership conference meaning of the game. Yeah.
Sorry.
Annie, didn't hear your last minute. Could you repeat that? I mean, it sounded like it looked like it was just brilliant, but something happened technically with the connection.
Yeah, what were you trying to get at with the Soul of America question?
No. know.
Sorry. You can type it in. We can come back to it. I did like where it was going, though. That to me is very interesting, especially when that rhetoric is on both sides of the aisle in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear us?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Where did I cut off? I'm sorry.
What are you trying to say about the Soul of America and the DNC?
Yeah, well, so I was noticing the parallel between Saving the Soul of America and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference's Redeeming the Soul of America. And I was just kind of wondering how that would parallel to now and how we can put the phrase redeeming the soul of America from, you know, the 60s. How does that reflect to now?
Yeah, no, that's helpful. That's helpful.
I hear you asking, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, what does it even mean to talk about redeeming the soul of the nation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, man. I have so many different thoughts related to this. I mean, I think one question with redemption is the scope of redemption. Like, what are we talking about? What are we talking about when we say America, right? And so I think there are at least two different kind of levels where I could see people today wanting to see that happen, right? One level is at the structural level, right? So like, how do we think about the structures in our society actually being more equitable? How do we think about the structures in our society not leading to the same levels of disparities that they have in the past? But then there's also like the cultural aspect of like redeeming. When you talk about redeeming the soul, it feels less, in some ways it can be tangible, but it feels like less tangible, like more like the culture of a place. And I personally think that's actually I don't know if it's harder. In some ways it can feel harder because like changing culture is very, very hard. It's hard for like an individual institution to change its culture. Mm-hmm. And so you think about that on like a societal level, I think that's very difficult, but I think that's part of what, you know, if we were to import people using that language in the 60s into today, I think that's part of what they would have in mind. They would have in mind both kind of the structural changes, but also the cultural changes. So for example, if you take Brown v. Board of Education, right? And you take the desegregation or integration of schools, that's a structural change, but that's separate from the culture of the educational institution actually changing, right? Or that's different than, you know, white teachers deciding to treat everyone equally or vice versa. Like, that to me, it's a different level than just the structures. But I think when we think about what redemption means, redemption is a more all-encompassing term. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what, if someone were brought into today from 1960s, I think they would have those types of things in mind, both structures and culture. But what they would not have in mind is just talking about changed hearts. Because I think for anyone who's an active part of the civil rights movement, they recognize that that was not enough. So great question.
Thank you.
I wanted, like, on this chain of thought, I wanted to ask if, well, I guess like from my perspective, it seems like there was a shift in the 20th century in a lot of white American religions towards an almost like apocalyptic focus. So I was wondering if there, you see any like correlation between kind of this canonization of a exodus narrative amongst Black communities in an apocalyptic, like a newly formed apocalyptic narrative among white communities.
Whoa. So you're asking, do I see a connection between those two things?
Yeah. Is there like a correlation, especially amongst like, I think, white evangelicals today?
Ooh. I think yes, in some ways. That's an interesting question. The only reason I'm hesitating is I think there's slightly different logics at play there, right? So the reason I'm thinking about this is like within some communities where apocalypticism is a big deal, it's actually apocalypticism in what we would call like a premillennial frame. So it's a bunch of jargon just to say apocalypticism can be framed in a way that presumes, you know, things have been getting really bad and God's going to come and fix things, which is different than an apocalyptic frame that is more post-millennial that suggests things are getting bad, but like we can work together to usher in God's kingdom to bring about good things. And so those that feels slightly different than, like, if you're in a premillennial framework and expecting for God to like come out of the sky and fix everything all of a sudden, that's a different sensibility than if you're in an Exodus framework where you're not necessarily living with that type of immediate expectation. And so I say like there's a slight difference in terms of like the future that both of those camps have in mind and what that future looks like in terms of how they get to freedom, flourishing, all those things. I think what's similar is in both situations, regardless of which framework you're talking about, there is a similarity of connecting oneself with the biblical narrative, right? So like whether that's Israel coming through the Exodus or whether that's Christians, witnessing the coming of Christ to make all things new and to fix everything. Like I think the identification as God's people is similar, but what the path to freedom and flourishing looks like is a bit different. Hopefully that makes sense.
May I? This has just been terrific and exceedingly helpful in so many ways, Nathan. And I'm wondering if I might just ask a final question.
Sure.
Thanks to all of you for making this such a productive and inspiring exchange. I think I sent around a tweet that Barna Research Group did a new poll recently. It's one of these like Pew and other research polling organizations that tracks religious behavior in America. Ruth Graham, no relation to Billy Graham, Ruth Graham writes for the New York Times, tweeted out one of the highlights yesterday, or depressing conclusions. And I sent this around, 36% of white self-identified Christians say they are not motivated to address racial injustice, a leap from 16% last year. And then there's the full story at religionnews.com. And I guess I would just want to ask you kind of more broadly, as a scholar, as a pastor, and as kind of a community organizer, builder, who travels, in the company of the civil rights saints, along with the others and the great cloud of witnesses, how do you approach, on a personal level or in a group dynamic, the matter of white racism? How do you think that, in what ways do those various streams of commitments for you, coming out of this kind of immersion in Martin Luther King and the spirituality of nonviolence, and this kind of motif of reconciliation, redemption, and creation of beloved community. Like, how does that illuminate perhaps a distinctive way of engaging, racism, or more kind of, baldly, I guess, anti-racist training? How does that give you perhaps a distinctive way or particular ways of thinking about how you engage the racist other that may kind of help, illuminate, some rhetorical, strategic, kind of mm-hmm. philosophical kind of differences, alternatives, or from some of the currently kind of widely rehearsed ways of engaging racism. I mean, like, how do you kind of approach that, Nathan? I've never asked you that question.
Great. No, it's great. It's got my wheels turning in my head. I have lots of different things to say about this, but let me just say, you know, as I think about some of my own kind of like intellectual formation, theological formation, one thing that has helped me to recognize is, there's a couple of different things. So I'll give you an example. Someone sent me an email and they said, "Hey, I've been reading Dr. Perkins and he told me, or I've read him and it sounds like the best way," it's the white male. He said, it seemed like the best way to learn about these issues after George Floyd died and all that stuff, or was murdered, the best way to learn about some of these issues and what's happening is to talk with someone Black to hear their story.
Okay, tell us who John Perkins is real quick.
Oh man, y'all haven't got John Perkins yet? So, sorry, my voice got real high. I got excited. John Perkins is basically one of the main founders of CCDA, Christian Community Development Association. He's the trailblazer in Christian community development approaches around the country. He's awesome. He's a living saint. He's just turned 90 years old. He's great. Look him up. Google him. Where was I going with this? Oh, so someone emails me and they said, "Hey, I've been reading him," because Perkins talks a lot about reconciliation and that type of thing. And so this guy wanted to meet with me to ask me about my experience, which I have lots of thoughts about that because I get that type of email a lot. And it's both encouraging and really annoying sometimes. But my encouragement to him initially was I tried to give him some tools to before he starts to try to think about what it's like for me to be Black and like what my experience is like. I wanted him to be reflective about what it means to be white.
Yeah.
And I say that because, you know, as I think about my own intellectual formation, I think one of the ways it shaped me is it's pushed me to ask deeper questions about self-awareness. Because a lot of times when we're thinking about like changing the world and all that, we're looking outward instead of actually asking, like, what is it like for me to be me? Right? Like what are the conditions that actually allow me to live with the privilege or with the lack of privilege that I have? Right? Like what are those types of things? Because I feel like in our society, there's a lot of, and I don't say this to sound like a pompous academic. I think there's a lot of intellectual laziness, particularly in the church, where like we don't always ask very deep or intellectual questions, when in reality, asking some of those really perceptive questions can lead to our own liberation. Because we want easy answers, we don't want to learn about the history of, you know, our particular denomination's complicitness in, massive resistance, or we don't want to think about the fact that, oh, our denomination has this history of supporting slavery. and so, whereas if we actually reckon with our history and we choose not to be afraid of that history, then there's a possibility for, our future actually being redeemed in some way. And so I think being able to have some of those kind of frameworks to think about our current situation is helpful. And I think that's some of the stuff that I try to bring into my own work, right? So like, I remember I was talking with another executive director the week before I started my current job as executive director. And I was trying to pick his brain because I'm like, he's been doing this for a while. I want to learn how to do this for a while. And one of his encouragements to me was for me to lean into what I was already good at in terms of my training as a theologian. And so I think what that's helped me to do is to carry certain frameworks and sensibilities into this more like on the ground work. Because you think about King, right? King's on the ground doing things, but King has a PhD. Like King is shaped in the academy in a lot of ways. And so what he recognized was like, that's also a means towards, you know, him engaging in the real day-to-day struggles of his community. And so I think, you know, part of my kind of hope for my own work and for others who are engaged in this work is that we're able to make those connections between the intellectual resources that can help us to analyze our situation, and then also the actual opportunities to engage in that work. And that work actually begins internally. That work begins with looking in the mirror right? Because everybody's trying, well, not everybody, a lot of people are trying to do really good work. But some of the biggest problems that I've seen in especially like community development work is when we haven't stopped to ask ourselves, like, what are our motives? Like, why are we actually in this work? What are we trying to accomplish? What are things that are maybe preventing us from being effective? Like, if we don't ask those questions and we just jump in trying to be a savior, we'll actually cause more damage. And so I think being able to have a certain level of self-awareness and analytical rigor can actually equip us to engage in our work more responsibly. So hopefully that helps, but those are some of the things that run through my head when you ask the question.
Beautiful, thank you. This was wonderful. When are we going? When are we going to have a book to read?
I'm terrible. So I have a voicemail from a publisher. I told her I was going to send in a proposal. It was a while ago, and I haven't gotten to it. But I'm going to let her know it's coming. I'm working on it.
Okay.
So my initial goal is actually to have something ready by the election. You know, but that probably won't work out.
That's fine. I mean, there's so much coming out around the election. It's just,
I've got irons in the fire, though. Irons are in the fire. They just need to get
The kind of work you're doing, you know, has kind of a reparative quality. So, you know, coming, you know, after November has its own benefits, but. We really are grateful to you for coming to share your work and your wisdom and helping us in our own journeys navigate these issues. So thanks, Nathan.
Thanks for having me. It was fun. Good seeing y'all.
Can you clap virtually? How do you clap virtually? Oh yeah. Well,
there we go. Appreciate it. You guys made it productive. Thank you for your really help.
Okay, thanks. Love to Diamond.
We'll do.
And just the core group, be in touch. I want to ask you about the book thing sometime soon.
Yes, definitely.
If the class can just hang in here for one second.
See y'all later.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Charles.
Bye, Dylan. So good seeing you.
Yeah.
Take care. Hey, folks, that was really helpful. And thanks for asking such probing and illuminating questions. Let's take the first half hour in our seminar time next week to look at to finish our conversation on MLK. In particular, I will send around 3 or 4 passages from the reading that I think we should attend to before moving into the theology of white supremacy. So we'll finish Martin Luther King next week. First half hour of the seminar. I'm trying to look to see. So these are really 3 superb readings, and Isaac, I think these are all online now. Is that correct? Or these are all in Colab?
They should be. I'll double check, and if they're not up, they'll be up by the end of the day.
Okay. Any questions? Well, we've been sitting a long time, so. Why don't we break for the week? And I wish each of you a lovely evening. It's a fair, cool evening here in Charlottesville. Those of you who are still out in Texas, is it hot and humid out there? Yeah. Well, I'm around. If you want to talk anytime, you all have my cell phone number. You know, let me know if you have any questions. And I'm you know, available and eager to talk and to answer and just to hear about what you're up to. So thanks again. Good evening. Bye.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Bye. Bye-bye, Andrew. Yeah, take care.
Bye.
Hey, Isaac, can I grab you real quickly? virtually.
Yeah, come on. Let me ask.